Would you like for us to post information about your congregation on the Find a Church page of our website? We'll add your church when it becomes part of the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's mission or advertising budget. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 at issuesetc.org. Click support and publicize your congregation to the world.
I have a message from the Tea Party. We've come to take our government back. Washington is horribly broken, and this Tea Party movement is a message to Washington that we're unhappy and that we want things done differently.
This is what democracy looks like. A win for the people.
It's been a great privilege to be in the United States Senate. I'll be working very, very hard for the people of the Commonwealth in the coming months.
Well, those are some of the sounds coming out of yesterday's Super Tuesday elections and their results. Some surprises, although I imagine if you're a big follower of the Tea Party, you might have said, oh, we saw this one coming. It's an avalanche. Things are going to happen here. And the sentiment against incumbency is very strong, or so it appears. One wonders what result it will have in the midterm elections. And that's a big question. We're going to talk about the Super Tuesday elections on this Wednesday afternoon, May the 19th. Mark Hemingway joins us for the first half hour of the program. He's editorial page staff writer for the Washington Examiner. In the second half of today's program, I want you to answer the questions. My question to you is, do you think there should be a Protestant on the U.S. Supreme Court? John Paul Stevens is retiring. He is the last Protestant on the U.S. Supreme Court. If confirmed, the nominee that would take his place, Elena Kagan, is Jewish. And that would make, if I'm counting correctly, three Jews on the U.S. Supreme Court and the rest are Roman Catholic, no Protestants on the U.S. Supreme Court for the first time, perhaps, I'm not sure, but perhaps forever since the Supreme Court was established. Does the Supreme Court need a Protestant voice there, especially given the strong Protestant voice in the U.S. population? Does it signal the decline of Protestantism to not have a Protestant on the U.S. Supreme Court? I want your answer to those questions in a half hour. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Email us here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, talkback@issuesetc.org, Twitter us at @issuesetc, or leave your answer to the question for audio open lines in 25 minutes at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Mark Hemingway is a regular guest, editorial page staff writer for the Washington Examiner. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Which of the two major parties, Republican or Democratic, should be more concerned about the growing power and influence of the Tea Party?
Can't they both lose, Todd? No, you know, I mean, seriously, if you want a straight answer to that question, I mean, you know, a lot of that, you know, seems fairly obvious. I mean, what the Tea Partiers are for in terms of, you know, anti-statism and you know, fiscal responsibility, you know, lower taxes sort of thing, definitely dovetails more with the Republican message. And, you know, combine that with the fact that the Democrats are the party currently in power and have the most to lose from, you know, an overall anti-incumbent sentiment. It's pretty clear that the Tea Party is more aligned with the GOP. But that said, you know, I think when we saw, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of people talking about Rand Paul's, you know, pretty, you know, decisive victory in Kentucky yesterday, that the GOP establishment is not going to be able to dictate, you know, what GOP party base voters are going to do. You know, in the past, you know, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, or, you know, National Republican Congressional Committee or whatever could come into, you know, a race and sort of dictate how things were going to go down. But now the grassroots movement, particularly fed by the Tea Party stuff, seems much more active at the local level and, you know, is able to go in there and get, you know, outsider candidates the kind of momentum they need to actually, you know, win races. And you're also seeing fundraising for the RNC and, you know, the traditional Republican apparatuses, you know, dry up at the same time. Republican fortunes, you know, politically are booming. So, you know, clearly the Republicans have a lot to lose from, you know, the Tea Party ascendancy.
So there's a stronger association there. What is the Tea Party's message to the Republican establishment in a nutshell?
Well, I mean, I think the message is that, you know, it can't be business as usual. The Republicans, for, you know, basically, I mean, ever since, you know, 1994, have been, you know, getting reelected and telling the base that they're for limited government, and they're for, they're for lowering your tax bill and, you know, all these other traditional Republican messages. But in reality, I mean, they haven't lived up to really any of those goals. I mean, you know, George Bush expanded the size of government more than any president since, you know, Lyndon Baines Johnson and Great Society era. You know, he gave us a brand new prescription drug, you know, entitlement. And, you know, spending and everything generally went through the roof under Bush and the Republican Congress. So people are fed up. You know, they elected these people who claim to be, you know, fiscally responsible, limited government Republicans, and then they get into office and, you know, they do exactly the opposite.
Let's talk the particulars of yesterday's, some of the highlights there. What did happen in Kentucky?
Well, basically what happened is that Rand Paul, who is the son of Ron Paul, the libertarian congressman from Texas, won his Senate primary in Kentucky over a guy named Trey Grayson. And, you know, Trey Grayson, you know, was not a, you know, bad guy or a bad conservative or even a bad choice at all for Republican voters. But the problem is that some of the Republican establishment, you know, Mitch McConnell, the current, you know, House, the current Senate minority leader, who's also the other senator from Kentucky, you know, came in there and tried to throw his weight around and try and influence the outcome of that election. And, you know, and by default, Grayson became the, you know, GOP establishment candidate. And that's not what voters wanted. Rand Paul, for better or for worse, he has sort of the imprimatur of his father, which is, you know, someone who has, you know, really incorruptible standards about, you know, certain issues, almost to a fault. And people, I think, are looking for that kind of conviction in someone that they send to office right now, because it's going to be some really difficult times and some really difficult challenges, and these people are going to do some stuff to stand on principle, you know. Do I know that Rand Paul is necessarily that guy? I don't, but, you know, he certainly, you know, was good at projecting that image as both an outsider candidate and someone with, you know, real principles and someone who was going to do things very differently than the GOP orthodoxy.
What about Pennsylvania? What happened there?
Well, there were two big developments in Pennsylvania. One is that Arlen Specter, who's been the senator from Pennsylvania for 29 years now, lost the primary election. And, of course, this was interesting because Arlen Specter was a Republican almost his entire career. I mean, he was a liberal Republican, very liberal Republican at times, but a Republican nonetheless. Well, you know, after he voted for the stimulus bill and some other things last year, Arlen Specter switched parties, which, you know, gave the Democrats the filibuster proof, you know, supermajority they needed to, you know, advance the health care bill and some other stuff at some critical junctures. And, you know, Specter thought that by switching parties it would sort of, you know, help preserve his chances of getting elected again, because, you know, Obama was, you know, very popular, you know, at the time, and, you know, Democrats still seemed to be ascendant. Well, with health care reform dragging on and voters getting frustrated whenever Democrats' fortunes started to, you know, plunge, you know, and further the Democratic Party base, you know, understandably was not happy about having a liberal Republican foisted upon them as a new, you know, Democrat. You know, even as a liberal Republican, he was still a lot more conservative than the more, you know, liberal base of the Democratic Party would have liked. So next thing you know, Specter had a very serious primary challenge from a guy named Joe Sestak, who's a congressman from Pennsylvania and a former Navy admiral. Sestak challenged Specter from the left, and he despite the fact that Specter had the backing of the White House and pretty powerful, you know, organization, everything, and name recognition in the state and everything behind him, he lost with this guy Joe Sestak sort of, you know, running from behind, neck and neck or whatever, and finally Sestak overtook him last night, and basically Specter's 30 years in the United States Senate are effectively done. And the second development would be that there was a special election to replace John Murtha in Pennsylvania's 12th congressional district. In that case, people were looking at this closely because this is a district that had gone for McCain in the last election. It's even though Democratic voter registrations outnumber Republicans 2-1, it's a very socially conservative district, it had been sort of trending conservative. Murtha had made some mistakes in his last reelection campaign before he died, and there was a lot of there was even some speculation that he might have even been beaten, even though in that last election, right up until the end, when he ended up winning by 10 or 12 points, regardless. But still, there was some hope that this district was trending conservative, and with all the GOP momentum, the GOP would be able to take back that seat. Well, the GOP did not take back that seat. The Democrat won by 8 points, and this sort of confounded a lot of Tea Party Republican ascendancy narratives, because if Tea Parties and Republicans and all these things generally are headed for a big blowout year, this is the kind of thing you start to see. You start to see them pick up, special elections and, difficult or moderately Democratic districts, that would be, that would show signs of an impending wave. So the lesson from the fact that Republicans didn't win there sort of remains to be seen. I would say that the results do show that Republicans need to not take things for granted. At the same time, the Republicans did not count on what happened with the Specter-Sestak race. Basically, in the last couple of weeks, all of a sudden, the Democratic primary that had sort of been a foregone conclusion, all of a sudden heated up and became this major statewide election. So it drove Democratic turnout way, way up. According to the NRCC, they were expecting 60,000 Democrats to show up and vote in that election. 83,000 Democrats showed up to vote in that election. Turnout for Democrats was off the hook, whereas there wasn't really a significant Republican primary at the top of the ticket. So there was an abnormal turnout for Democrats. So it may not confound the Republican Tea Party narratives, and it may not be an indication that Republicans are going to have a big blowout in November.
Mark Hemingway is our guest. He'll be with us for another 10 minutes on the other side of the break this Wednesday afternoon, May the 19th. We'll talk about the Super Tuesday elections when we come back. Let's see. In Arkansas, why was Senator Blanche Lincoln, why is he going to have to engage in a runoff? We'll answer that question after this. We'll talk more about the Tea Party power. Stay tuned. Because you are. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line. 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7. 618-223-8384.
So what's the fad du jour at your church? Beth Moore, Rick Warren, post-emergent, pre-emergent, or some other move of the spirit that hasn't quite hit you yet? At the Brothers of John the Steadfast, we're kicking it old school. And by old school, I mean the 1580 Book of Concord. Check out our website for a list of confessional study groups, or if you have one at your congregation, you can let us know. www.steadfastlutherans.com.
Politician, can you make it right? decision for all of us. Yeah, for all of us.
It's Wednesday afternoon, May the 19th. What do you think about the Super Tuesday elections? Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-6943. Email us here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org, Twitter us at issuesetc. Mark Hemingway is our guest, editorial page staff writer for the Washington Examiner. Mark, let's talk about what happened to Senator Blanche Lincoln. Why is she now facing a runoff in the primary?
Arkansas basically just has a law that says that, or the way the primary system there works, is that if you don't get 50% of the vote in your election or whatever, even when there's multiple candidates, you have to go to a runoff with the top two vote getters or whatever. Blanche Lincoln did not get 50%, and it looks like she, you know, is probably going to lose her primary once she goes to the runoff. Arkansas is a very strange state. Obviously, it's sort of dyed-in-the-wool Democratic, but near as I can tell, that is a result of some outlying historical events and just, you know, a party machinery apparatus there that I think is on the way out. The state as a whole is much more in common with the South, and I don't know. We'll see. This might finally be the year where Arkansas really sort of, you know, tips over and, you know, goes from purple to red. A lot of things that Blanche Lincoln supported in the Senate, you know, in terms of her positions on health care and other things like that, were phenomenally unpopular back in her home state. So I'm not terrible. This isn't shocking news to anyone.
No, this wasn't Super Tuesday, but it was last week in Utah. What happened there, Mark?
In Utah?
Yeah.
Basically, the incumbent Senator Bennett didn't win his primary in the state. This is, again, another situation where, you know, Bennett isn't necessarily a, you know, bad conservative or anything like that, but in a year where the Tea Parties are, you know, are ascendant big time or whatever, you know, Bennett had been, you know, he was a good legislator, but, you know, kind of moderate Republican on some issues. He had been, you know, voted in favor of TARP and some other things that did not sit well with, you know, the GOP base. And the fact of the matter is it's always sort of amazed me that Utah has, you know, has had, you know, such moderate Republican senators in Orrin Hatch and Bennett, because, I mean, you have a state that's like, you know, 85% Republican or something like that. I mean, it's just absurd. And the idea that under those conditions you wouldn't, you know, be able to elect, you know, the most conservative candidates possible always seemed a bit odd. So, you know, I don't know. To some extent, you know, Bennett was sort of, you know, counting on, you know, the incumbency to carry the day. But, you know, again, the shots across the bow for incumbents have definitely been fired. So we'll see. Can't really count on anything if you're an incumbent. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you've got money, name recognition, all the usual advantages. This is not the year to take things for granted if you're an incumbent.
Okay, let's come back to the Tea Party. Two questions occur to me. One is, can a movement subsist entirely on dissatisfaction? Kind of the way things are, it shouldn't be that way, but with a lot less on the other side of the ledger, that is positive proposals for what should be done?
Well, that is a darn good question. But the thing is, I mean, I think you could ask that question of just about any popular political movement in America. You know, it's very hard to, you know, get a bunch of, you know, a large group of, you know, large coalition, you know, and get everybody to agree on a very specific agenda and everything you want to outline, you know, in terms of, you know, the broad goals and the directions that they're pushing them in. I mean, I think it's clear that, you know, what the goals, what they want, you know, whether they want less taxation, they want, you know, something to be done about federal spending, you know, that's clear. You know, I don't know if how they get to those goals is as important as, you know, the goals themselves. But yeah, no, that's a good question. I don't really have any particular, you know, good answers for it, because, I mean, I think it's true you could ask that of, you know, just about any popular political movement. You know, I mean, maybe the progressive movement in the early part of the 20th century, whatever, was a little different in that they had these really weird specific ideas, be it, you know, prohibition or be it, you know, direct election of senators or something like that. But we haven't seen too many popular political movements with you know, that specific of goals that have, you know, been that successful anyway, so...
The Republican establishment, I think, hopes that the Tea Party movement will help them kind of usher in the second coming of 1994 in the midterms? Do you think it's really going to happen?
I mean, I think that based on what we're seeing, the idea of a Republican takeover of the House of Representatives is basically, you know, almost a foregone conclusion. I mean, I think most sane observers are looking at this, are looking at, you know, 40 to 50 seat takeover, you know, but then again, you know, there's some other people that are pointing to, you know, different statistics and things like that, that, you know, show that, you know, 70, 80, you know, 90 seats or more could be possible under current conditions. You know, it just depends a lot on what happens between now and then. What happens between now and then, and, you know, how well Republicans and, more importantly, you know, Tea Partiers and independent you know, political donors and stuff are organized and are able to, you know, capitalize on this, you know, clear shift away from what's been going on with the Democratic rule in Congress. So I think it's important to remember that a lot of what's going on here isn't fueled so much as a like for these, you know, Republican candidates that are running for office. As you pointed out, it's so much as revulsion to what's going on under Democratic leadership.
The White House is obviously watching this, Mark. Do you think that yesterday's election results will influence how President Obama governs in the next few months?
You know, that is a good question. I you know, well, we're already seeing that. I mean, the bottom line is that at the end of the day, you know, Obama is the president. He's a separate branch of government. He can't exactly tell Democrats what to do, which is why you're seeing some fairly crazy and unprecedented things going on in the House right now. Like, for instance, they are not going to do a budget this year because they don't want to call attention to the fact that, you know, they're spending all this money and spending's gone way up. You know, even, you know, as bad as it was under Bush, it's worse under Obama, and so Democrats don't want to draw attention to this. So they're already sort of, you know, governing scared and governing defensively. And I'm not sure that that's, you know, necessarily the best strategy, but on the other hand, I'm not sure it would be good to go ahead and remind voters of what they're doing anyway. The, you know, as for what, you know, Obama does, you know, I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of stuff that convinces me that Democrats quite get that this is for real. You know, Obama and the Democratic leadership seem to be really pushing that they really still think that if they, you know, highlight certain provisions that are contained in the health care reform package they just passed that test well or are popular, that this is going to help them in November, and they're still trying to push that message. I haven't seen any polling data or just, you know, any sort of, you know, common sense observers that seem to think that that is a good idea, and yet this is, you know, the message that the president is pushing. But, you know, as far as the president's concerned, I think the one takeaway from yesterday that, you know, again, you know, that maybe we should, you know, focus in on is that, you know, remember what things were like a year ago. You know, granted, you know, he hasn't been president that long, but, you know, Obama came in with lots of goodwill and, you know, was this, you know, shiny new thing and very charismatic, and everyone was, you know, looking at him as, you know, this leader, and he had this Midas touch that he could, you know, pass on his magic to whoever. Well, the bottom line is, you know, Obama has now gone out there and he's, you know, endorsed John Corzine in New Jersey, lost, why am I blanking? The Democrat who ran for governor of Virginia, anyway, sorry, I'm sick. I can't remember. Cray Deeds ran for governor of Virginia, who lost. Martha Coakley ran for Senate in Massachusetts, lost. That was a huge deal. You know, came out, you know, swinging for Arlen Specter again, you know, lost. You know, Blanche Lincoln wouldn't even have him near Arkansas because he's so unpopular there. So the idea that Obama is going to be the Democrat savior, or the idea that whenever Democrats have an issue that's unpopular, they can just, you know, trot out their secret weapon and have Obama give a speech and endorse something, then all of a sudden the American people will like it. You know, the days of that are just, I mean, they're done. I mean, that horse is dead and buried, and the Democrats need to find a new message and move on from there, and I'm not sure they're prepared to do that yet.
Then with only about 30 seconds, Mark, how vulnerable is Senator John McCain in Arizona?
I don't think he's ultimately that vulnerable. Excuse me. J.D. Hayworth, the guy running against him, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people in the conservative base that like him, and certainly McCain's flip-flop on Arizona looks craven. But at the same time, I think, you know, McCain, whether it's, you know, honest or not, can make a credible argument that the threat of the border has worsened enough to justify flipping his position there. And as long as he remains, you know, good on border security, I think he'll do just fine.
Maybe 20 seconds real quick on this. Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings have been scheduled for the very end of June. That's pretty soon. Do you think there's anything in that other than just wanting to get it over with?
I don't really know. I mean, Republicans should kick up a fuss, you know, because they need to make an argument about judicial philosophies as a general rule. But, you know, as far as, you know, a Democratic pick for the Supreme Court, my personal opinion is you could do a lot worse than Elena Kagan. And getting back to the question you asked the viewers, I just would like to say that since Rehnquist left the court there, we are badly in need of another Lutheran. And I think that we should, you know, we should consider that.
Thank you very much, Mark. We'll see what we can do about that, although probably not very much. Mark Hemingway is editorial page staff writer for The Washington Examiner. Mark, thanks for being our guest, and I really hope you feel better.
Thank you.
We will post a link to his columns under the Listen on Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. When we come back, there's the question for you. Mark's already given you his answer. Should there be a Protestant on the U.S. Supreme Court? With the resignation of John Paul Stevens, there won't be. And given the likelihood of Elena Kagan's confirmation after she's nominated here, that will make it three Jewish judges and the rest of them are Roman Catholic, no Protestants. Should there be a Protestant on the U.S. Supreme Court? Answer to that question right after this.
Mr. Politician, please don't deceive us, Mr. Politician. You're there to believe us. Just how can you tell, Mr. Winter?
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come. Join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30. And find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
Will your church be one of the Issues Etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues Etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues Etc. 300, click the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues Etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues Etc. 300.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Statistics undermine claim that abortion can be safe.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The 54th session of the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women recently touted a connection between legal abortion and low maternal mortality rates. But the Latin American country of Chile shows a different story. Chile does not allow abortions, even for life of the mother, and rejected UN calls to liberalize its abortion laws. Yet Chile's maternal death rate has plummeted since 1960. Today, Chile has both the lowest maternal mortality rate and tightest abortion laws in Latin America. Seems like the safest abortion is none at all.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.